The Novels of Charles Dickens. An Introduction by David Timson. A Tale of Two Cities. 1858 was a difficult year for Charles Dickens. It was not, for him, the best of times, but the worst of times, to quote the opening line of the novel that came out of these troubled times the following year, A Tale of Two Cities. Some aspects of the novel had been in Dickens's mind for some time, such as the idea of a man imprisoned for 15 years and the effect of this incarceration on his mind. And one of the possible titles that Dickens considered that reflected this theme was Buried Alive. But the central idea of the plot of this new novel was inspired by Dickens's amateur production of The Frozen Deep in 1857. It is a melodrama written by his friend Wilkie Collins, in which two men love the same woman, and one, Richard Wardour, the part Dickens played, sacrifices himself to save the other. These pieces of plot involving rivalry, renunciation, and self-sacrifice provided Dickens with his starting point for the novel, and are presented as the triangle of Lucy Manette, Sidney Carton, and Charles Darnay. He also takes the dominant mood of Collins's play into his novel, treating this plot with sentiment and melodrama. But The Frozen Deep was to have a deeper significance for Dickens and his family. When it was revived for a charity matinee in Manchester in August of 1857, the female parts, which Dickens's daughters had played, were now played by professional actresses, among whom was an attractive young girl called Ellen Ternan. Dickens fell hopelessly in love with her, despite the fact that he was 45 and she was 18. Dickens had felt for some time that his marriage to Catherine had stagnated. He had been restless and on the lookout for something to divert him. Throughout 1858, Dickens pursued Ellen relentlessly until she reluctantly gave in. With his usual thoroughness, Dickens published a letter in The Times and his own periodical Household Words, informing his public of his separation from his wife, providing, from a strong sense of guilt, no doubt, details of their failed relationship as an attempt to justify his actions. It was against this difficult background that Dickens, in 1859, began to write A Tale of Two Cities. In keeping with the dramatic changes in his domestic life, Dickens was attempting to do something new in A Tale of Two Cities. First and foremost, he wanted to write an historical novel, and the historical theme he chose was the French Revolution. Dickens meticulously researched his facts by reading Thomas Carlyle's epic account. He actually wrote to Carlyle for information about source books, and was staggered to receive 2 cartloads of books from the historian. Dickens wanted to write sweeping, panoramic scenes depicting real events rather than a novel based on character and humorous satirical observation, for which he was famous. A novel where domestic events are led by world events, and the plot dominates. This resulted in a novel that is short on memorable or humorous characters, most of the humour being given to Miss Pross, the very proper lady's companion of the young heroine Lucy Manette. The broad brushstrokes of the plot also tend towards a dependency on melodramatic moments rather than subtlety. Indeed, one of the strongest characters in the book is the revolutionary mob itself. The burst wine cask and the hordes of poor who lap up the spillage, the storming of the Bastille, where the mob is like a sea, the crowded tribunal that arraigns Darnay and the scenes at the guillotine. These set pieces achieve Dickens's proclaimed intention of creating a picturesque story. Carlyle's The French Revolution, A History, 1837, is history for the Victorians. Its style is grandiose, with an apocalyptic style designed to show how much the Victorian age had moved the world forwards since those days. It is a tone that Dickens too adopts to assist the presentation of the story as an allegory, the conflict between light and darkness, and the regenerative power of mankind. The novel's darkness, represented by the revolutionaries, contains some of Dickens' strongest writing. The character of Madame Defarge, a ruthless fanatic, is boldly drawn, her evident sexuality making her almost attractive in her fervour. Set against her, the representative of light, Lucy Manette, seems passive and weak. Much more defined is her father, Dr. Manette. Imprisoned in solitary confinement by the old regime, he is released a broken man and afraid of the world, frequently retreating back into the obsessive behaviour he exhibited in prison, cobbling shoes. Dickens' own circumstances no doubt led him to identify with this character's sense of isolation. Manette, like Carton at the end of the novel, moves from darkness into light. Though not a huge success in its day, A Tale of Two Cities has gained in popularity, largely because of its strong plot and at least two film adaptations.
It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom, it was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief, it was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light, it was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope, it was the winter of despair. We had everything before us, we had nothing before us. We were all going direct to heaven, we were all going direct the other way. In short, the period was so far like the present period that some of its noisiest authorities insisted on its being received, for good or for evil, in the superlative degree of comparison only. There were a king with a large jaw and a queen with a plain face on the throne of England. There were a king with a large jaw and a queen with a fair face on the throne of France. In both countries, it was clearer than crystal to the lords of the state preserves of loaves and fishes that things in general were settled forever. It was the year of our Lord 1775. Spiritual revelations were conceded to England at that favoured period, as at this. Mrs. Southcote had recently attained her 25th blessed birthday, of whom a prophetic private in the Life Guards had heralded the sublime appearance by announcing that arrangements were made for the swallowing up of London and Westminster. Even the Cock Lane ghost had been laid only a round dozen of years, after rapping out its messages, as the spirits of this very year last past, supernaturally deficient in originality, rapped out theirs. Mere messages in the earthly order of events had lately come to the English crown and people from a congress of British subjects in America, which, strange to relate, had proved more important to the human race than any communications yet received through any of the chickens of the Cock Lane brood. France, less favoured on the whole as to matters spiritual than her sister of the shield and trident, rolled with exceeding smoothness downhill, making paper money and spending it. Under the guidance of her Christian pastors, she entertained herself besides with such humane achievements as sentencing a youth to have his hands cut off, his tongue torn out with pincers, and his body burned alive, because he had not kneeled down in the rain to do honour to a dirty procession of monks which passed within his view, at a distance of some 50 or 60 yards. It is likely enough that, rooted in the woods of France and Norway, there were growing trees when that sufferer was put to death, already marked by the woodman fate, to come down and be sawn into boards, to make a certain movable framework with a sack and a knife in it, terrible in history. It is likely enough that in the rough outhouses of some tillers of the heavy lands adjacent to Paris, there were, sheltered from the weather that very day, rude carts, bespattered with rustic mire, snuffed about by pigs and roosted in by poultry, which the farmer Death had already set apart to be his tumbrils of the revolution. But that woodman and that farmer, though they work unceasingly, work silently, and no one heard them as they went about with muffled tread. The rather, for as much as to entertain any suspicion that they were awake, was to be atheistical and traitorous. In England, there was scarcely an amount of order and protection to justify much national boasting. Daring burglaries by armed men and highway robberies took place in the capital itself every night. Families were publicly cautioned not to go out of town without removing their furniture to upholsterers' warehouses for security. The highwayman in the dark was a city tradesman in the light, and, being recognised and challenged by his fellow tradesmen, whom he stopped in his character of the captain, gallantly shot him through the head and rode away. The mail was waylaid by 7 robbers, and the guard shot 3 dead, and then got shot dead himself by the other 4, in consequence of the failure of his ammunition, after which the mail was robbed in peace. That magnificent potentate, the Lord Mayor of London, was made to stand and deliver on Turnham Green by 1 highwayman, who despoiled the illustrious creature in sight of all his retinue. Prisoners in London jails fought battles with their turnkeys, and the majesty of the law fired blunderbusses in among them, loaded with rounds of shot and ball. Thieves snipped off diamond crosses from the necks of noble lords at court drawing-rooms. Musketeers went into St. Giles's to search for contraband goods, and the mob fired on the musketeers, and the musketeers fired on the mob, and nobody thought any of these occurrences much out of the common way. In the midst of them, the hangman, ever busy and ever worse than useless, was in constant requisition, now stringing up long rows of miscellaneous criminals, now hanging a housebreaker on Saturday who had been taken on Tuesday, now burning people in the hand at Newgate by the dozen, and now burning pamphlets at the door of Westminster Hall, today taking the life of an atrocious murderer, and tomorrow of a wretched pilferer who had robbed a farmer's boy of 6 pence. All these things, and 1,000 like them, came to pass in and close upon the dear old year 1775. Environed by them, while the woodman and the farmer worked unheeded, those 2 of the large jaws, and those other 2 of the plain and the fair faces, trod with stir enough, and carried their divine rights with a high hand. Thus did the year 1775 conduct their greatnesses, and myriads of small creatures, the creatures of this chronicle among the rest, along the roads that lay before them.
A wine cask bursts.
A large cask of wine had been dropped and broken in the street. The accident had happened in getting it out of a cart. The cask had tumbled out with a run, the hoops had burst, and it lay on the stones just outside the door of the wine shop, shattered like a walnut shell. All the people within reach had suspended their business, or their idleness, to run to the spot and drink the wine. The rough, irregular stones of the street, pointing every way, and designed, one might have thought, expressly to lame all living creatures that approached them, had dammed it into little pools. These were surrounded, each by its own jostling group or crowd, according to its size. Some men kneeled down, made scoops of their 2 hands joined, and sipped, or tried to help women who bent over their shoulders to sip, before the wine had all run out between their fingers. Others, men and women, dipped in the puddles with little mugs of mutilated earthenware, or even with handkerchiefs from women's heads, which were squeezed dry into infants' mouths. Others made small mud embankments to stem the wine as it ran. Others, directed by lookers-on up at high windows, darted here and there to cut off little streams of wine that started away in new directions. Others devoted themselves to the sodden and lead-eyed pieces of the cask, licking and even champing the moister wine-rotted fragments with eager relish. There was no drainage to carry off the wine, and not only did it all get taken up, but so much mud got taken up along with it, that there might have been a scavenger in the street if anybody acquainted with it could have believed in such a miraculous presence. A shrill sound of laughter and of amused voices, voices of men, women and children, resounded in the street while this wine game lasted. There was little roughness in the sport and much playfulness. There was a special companionship in it, an observable inclination on the part of everyone to join some other one, which led, especially among the luckier or lighter-hearted, to frolicsome embraces, drinking of healths, shaking of hands, and even joining of hands and dancing 12 together. When the wine was gone, and the places where it had been most abundant were raked into a gridiron pattern by fingers, these demonstrations ceased, as suddenly as they had broken out. The man who had left his saw, sticking in the firewood he was cutting, set it in motion again. The woman who had left on a doorstep, the little pot of hot ashes, at which she had been trying to soften the pain in her own starved fingers and toes, or in those of her child, returned to it. Men with bare arms, matted locks, and cadaverous faces, who had emerged into the winter light from cellars, moved away to descend again. And a gloom gathered on the scene that appeared more natural to it than sunshine. The wine was red wine, and had stained the ground of the narrow street in the suburb of Saint-Antoine in Paris, where it was spilled. It had stained many hands, too, and many faces, and many naked feet, and many wooden shoes. The hands of the man who sawed the wood left red marks on the billets, and the forehead of the woman who nursed her baby was stained with the stain of the old rag she wound about her head again. Those who had been greedy with the staves of the cask had acquired a tigerish smear about the mouth, and one tall joker, so besmirched, his head more out of a long squalid bag of a nightcap than in it, scrawled upon a wall with his finger dipped in muddy wine lees, "Blood." The time was to come, when that wine too would be spilled on the street stones, and when the stain of it would be red upon many there.
Dr. Manette.
"Good day," said Monsieur Defarge, looking down at the white head that bent low over the shoemaking. It was raised for a moment, and a very faint voice responded to the salutation, as if it were at a distance.
"Good day."
"You are still hard at work, I see." After a long silence, the head was lifted for another moment, and the voice replied,
"Yes, I am working."
This time a pair of haggard eyes had looked at the questioner before the face had dropped again. The faintness of the voice was pitiable and dreadful. It was not the faintness of physical weakness, though confinement and hard fare no doubt had their part in it. Its deplorable peculiarity was that it was the faintness of solitude and disuse. It was like the last feeble echo of a sound made long and long ago. So entirely had it lost the life and resonance of the human voice, that it affected the senses like a once beautiful colour faded away into a poor, weak stain. So sunken and suppressed it was, that it was like a voice underground. So expressive it was of a hopeless and lost creature, that a famished traveller, wearied out by lonely wandering in a wilderness, would have remembered home and friends in such a tone before lying down to die. Some minutes of silent work had passed, and the haggard eyes had looked up again, not with any interest or curiosity, but with a dull mechanical perception beforehand that the spot where the only visitor they were aware of had stood was not yet empty.
"I want," said Defarge, who had not removed his gaze from the shoemaker, "to let in a little more light here. You can bear a little more?"
The shoemaker stopped his work, looked with a vacant air of listening at the floor on one side of him, then, similarly, at the floor on the other side of him, then upward at the speaker.
"What did you say?"
"You can bear a little more light?"
"I must bear it, if you let it in,"
laying the palest shadow of a stress upon the second word. The opened half-door was opened a little further, and secured at that angle for the time. A broad ray of light fell into the garret, and showed the workman, with an unfinished shoe upon his lap, pausing in his labour. His few common tools and various scraps of leather were at his feet and on his bench. He had a white beard, raggedly cut, but not very long, a hollow face, and exceedingly bright eyes. The hollowness and thinness of his face would have caused them to look large under his yet dark eyebrows and his confused white hair, though they had been really otherwise. But they were naturally large, and looked unnaturally so. His yellow rags of shirt lay open at the throat, and showed his body to be withered and worn. He, and his old canvas frock, and his loose stockings, and all his poor tatters of clothes, had in a long seclusion from direct light and air faded down to such a dull uniformity of parchment yellow that it would have been hard to say which was which. He had put up a hand between his eyes and the light, and the very bones of it seemed transparent. So he sat, with a steadfastly vacant gaze pausing in his work. He never looked at the figure before him without first looking down on this side of himself, then on that, as if he had lost the habit of associating place with sound. He never spoke without first wandering in this manner and forgetting to speak.
"Are you going to finish that pair of shoes today?"
asked Defarge, motioning to Mr. Lorry to come forward.
"What did you say?"
"Do you mean to finish that pair of shoes today?"
"I can't say that I mean to. I suppose so. I don't know."
But the question reminded him of his work, and he bent over it again.
Miss Pross versus Madame Defarge.
Madame Defarge looked coldly at her and said,
"The wife of Evrémonde. Where is she?"
It flashed upon Miss Pross's mind that the doors were all standing open and would suggest the flight. Her first act was to shut them. There were four in the room, and she shut them all. She then placed herself before the door of the chamber which Lucy had occupied. Madame Defarge's dark eyes followed her through this rapid movement and rested on her when it was finished. Miss Pross had nothing beautiful about her. Years had not tamed the wildness or softened the grimness of her appearance. But she, too, was a determined woman in her different way, and she measured Madame Defarge with her eyes, every inch.
"You might, from your appearance, be the wife of Lucifer," said Miss Pross in her breathing. "Nevertheless, you shall not get the better of me. I am an Englishwoman."
Madame Defarge looked at her scornfully, but still with something of Miss Pross's own perception that they, too, were at bay. She saw a tight, hard, wiry woman before her, as Mr. Lorry had seen in the same figure a woman with a strong hand in the years gone by. She knew full well that Miss Pross was the family's devoted friend. Miss Pross knew full well that Madame Defarge was the family's malevolent enemy.
"On my way yonder," said Madame
Defarge with a slight movement of her hand towards the fatal spot,
"where they reserve my chair and my knitting for me, I am come to make my compliments to her in passing. I wish to see her."
"I know that your intentions are evil," said Miss Pross, "and you may depend upon it I'll hold my own against them."
Each spoke in her own language. Neither understood the other's words. Both were very watchful, and intent to deduce from look and manner what the unintelligible words meant.
"It will do her no good to keep herself concealed from me at this moment," said Madame Defarge. "Good patriots will know what that means. Let me see her. Go tell her that I wish to see her. Do you hear?"
"If those eyes of yours were bedwinches," returned Miss Pross, "and I was an English four-poster, they shouldn't loose a splinter of me. No, you wicked foreign woman, I am your match."
Madame Defarge was not likely to follow these idiomatic remarks in detail, but she so far understood them as to perceive that she was set at naught.
"Woman imbecile and pig-like," said Madame Defarge, frowning. "I take no answer from you. I demand to see her. Either tell her that I demand to see her, or stand out of the way of the door and let me go to her."
This with an angry explanatory wave of her right arm.
"I little thought," said Miss Pross, "that I should ever want to understand your nonsensical language, but I would give all I have except the clothes I wear to know whether you suspect the truth or any part of it."
Neither of them for a single moment released the other's eyes. Madame Defarge had not moved from the spot where she stood when Miss Pross first became aware of her, but she now advanced one step.
"I am a Briton," said Miss Pross. "I am desperate. I don't care an English tuppence for myself. I know that the longer I keep you here, the greater hope there is for my Lady Bert. I'll not leave a handful of that dark hair upon your head if you lay a finger on me."
Thus Miss Pross, with a shake of her head and a flash of her eyes between every rapid sentence, and every rapid sentence a whole breath. Thus Miss Pross, who had never struck a blow in her life.
These extracts have been taken from the unabridged recording of A Tale of Two Cities, read by Anton Lesser for Naxos Audiobooks.